Welcome back to Arts About.
A show about art that's... No, what was it again?
A work of art.
A work of art in itself.
In itself, yes, well, very good.
Sorry, John's not here, so...
Clearly it's Mark. Back on the strap line, very good. You're going to need some practice, Mark. Yeah. Welcome back to Arts About, which is brought to you by the generosity of the McClelland Sculpture Park and Gallery. And you're here in the Audible Peace Studios with the obtuse and surprising Mark Stewart and me, Sally Bailey. John has some other pressing engagement today and can't be here, so we're a little short-handed this week. What are you going to be talking about, Mark?
Heaven and hell.
Oh, tiny subjects.
Yes.
Heaven and hell in a metaphorical sense or the actual heaven and hell?
In a Princess Park sense.
Oh, yes. Awful. Yep. Awful, awful, awful. Okay. Well, I don't know that I'll be looking forward to that, but it is incredible.
It's a short, very worthy. Statement, yeah,
yes,
short
okay. Statement. And anything else?
Bullies, sexist, racist, great authors are often awful, but keep
You touched on that last week. That's great.
We ran out of time. And I think we're going to be talking about John Olson's prints. No?
Yes, we are. John Cecil, local gallery owner and CEO of the online gallery ArtNet, is here with us this morning to talk about the exhibition of limited edition lithographs and etchings by the artist John Olson that's on at his gallery in Red Hill. So we'll be chatting with him about that. And as some of you may be aware, I stood for the electorate of Dunkley in the last election for the Arts Party. That was in 2016. And I was, as were most members of the creative community, completely outraged by the disregard afforded by the arts, the current Liberal government at the time, and in particular, Senator George Brandis, who was the Attorney General and Minister of the Arts, and the way he dismantled the Australia Council. The Arts Party didn't win any seats in that election, but we did make a noise that was heard and received a significant number of votes. In fact, 1.5 million Australians were as concerned about the state of things to use their vote as a protest. So we're going to talk to their new leader, Barry Keldoulis, and he's going to tell us what's happening in the Arts Party now, about then whether or not they're launching a new campaign, etc., etc.
Good luck.
Yeah. So, but before we do that, let's listen to Leon Russell with a track called Out in the Woods. I've never heard this before, which is probably just shows my ignorance, really, but there's kookaburras in this. Have a listen. Showing now at the John Cecil Fine Art Gallery in Red Hill is a collection of original etchings and lithographs of one of Australia's finest living artists. John Olson, who is now in his 90s, has become a household name with an AO, an OBE and countless awards of recognition for his work over the decades. He has a hotel dedicated to his work, which seems to be the current marker of success these days, but it is his older and less grand but possibly more delicate early work that's the subject of this exhibition of the original artist and limited edition prints hosted at John Cecil's gallery in Red Hill. Collector, gallery owner and director of the online gallery ArtNet, as well as friend of the show, John Cecil, joins us this morning to talk about this exhibition and also I hope to explain a little about the significance of the terms limited edition artist prints and why they're different from reproductions. Good morning, John Cecil.
Good morning, Sally. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, very welcome. It's great to have you on the show again. Tell us a little bit about what you've got in your gallery at Red Hill at the moment.
In terms of the show?
Yeah.
It's 25... works by John from the 70s and 80s, which I always thought was his most fertile period, especially in printmaking. And there are some works that were printed with Fred Jenness, who's the printmaker who lived in Sydney at the time, who's now retired, but is a world legend. Legendary printmaker.
Well, we've met him at your gallery on occasion, yes.
Good memory there, Sam.
Yes.
And then others from my own collection and some from various other collections. Port Jackson Press is a good example. They provided some prints. So they're really beautiful works. And prints, my real interest in original prints is that I see them as the democratic form of art because people can afford to buy a print, whereas they may not be able to buy a painting or a watercolour by mm-hmm. a major artist. You know, Olson's are over 100,000 now for even a fairly minor work, but the prints are in the $2,000 to $3,000 bracket, so a lot more affordable. But they appreciate at the same rate as a painting does.
Do they? So can you describe, because I know that there's a lot of discrepancy or people are not really sure, because sometimes you see reproductions that are also signed by artists. Can you just give us a little description of what the differences are and why that is so, why an original print is it values in the same way that a painting does, although at a lesser scale?
Okay. a true original print is where the artist works on the plate or the stone himself. And so the printmaker, Fred Jenness, would prepare the stone and then John would draw his marks on the stone before it was treated and then turned into a print. So there are a number of artist proofs that are put together first before they do the edition. The edition is done once the artist has signed off on the one that he thinks is exactly right, and then they do an edition of 50 or 30 prints. So these are original works of art. The stone is destroyed or the plate is destroyed,
right, yeah,
after the edition's printed, so they can't be redone, and they are regarded in Europe, for instance, or America. Picasso or Matisse, they all did original prints on stone. There was a famous printmaker in Paris called Murillo, so they are original works of art.
Yes.
Reproductions are actually a photograph taken of a drawing and then reproduced on an inkjet printer. Sometimes they're signed by the artist, but they're not the real thing.
Yes, of course. So they're mass-produced.
Well, they can
be. And they're a copy. They're a copy of the original, yes.
They're a reproduction of a photograph, yes.
Yes. And, of course, there are some fabulous ones now. Is it called Giclée printing, which is...
Yeah, well, Giclée is high-quality inkjet printing.
Yes.
Giclée means to spurt in French.
Oh, so that's of course, you would know that, Mark. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, it's not often used in the same context.
Is it not?
Well, we won't go into that, yes.
No, okay. So how have you come to collect his work? Did you know him?
Yes. Back in the 70s, 80s, I had a gallery in Melbourne and in Sydney called Impressions, and we specialised in original prints back then. And I had a close association with Port Jackson Press that was run by David Rankin. And he, with the help of some financiers, he managed to get some editions printed by Olson, Whiteley, Storia. You know, the major artists of the time were commissioned by Port Jackson Press to produce editions of prints. And I was fascinated by that, and used to have them in my gallery, and it's a lifelong lifelong love that I have for prints.
So do prints from that era have more value than say more? John Olson's is he still making prints or?
Well, he has recently made some of the reproduction prints, the Giclée prints.
Right.
But his printmaking, he's 90 years old now, John.
Yes.
So
He's slowing down.
Slowing down a little bit,
But he doesn't really need to work it so much these days.
Yeah, and the work he's done more recently has been what the public has demanded, which is frogs and pelicans and the like.
Yes, I have noticed. Mm. But then, so what I'm trying to figure out is, are the prints that were made in the 70s by Fred...
Jenness.
Yeah.
Are they considered to be more value than...
Well, they are in... By people who understand what printmaking is about.
Yes.
And it was also a very exciting era of John's life in terms of he was going out to Lake Eyre and doing those wonderful prints of what he called the Desert Sea.
Yes.
And his work with animals was just so humorous and energetic and wonderful. And that era is really a very special time in his life for printmaking.
Okay.
Because I would have... Yeah, I mean, he came back from a stint in Europe, didn't he, with fresh eyes on Australia and really changed the way that painting, well, landscapes were seen or certainly painted by white folk here in Australia. It was really a very different way of looking at things, wasn't it, that he brought back with him?
The European approach.
Yes. Well, in the 60s when he, because didn't he return from Spain around about then?
Yeah, he was in Barcelona.
Yeah.
Right. And... his paintings, I went just sort of researching a little bit, went back and had a look at some of them from around that time, and I can't imagine that anybody else was painting like that.
Oh, no, John's work is unique. And
yeah.
He is also tempered or flavoured with his love of food. And when he came back from Spain, he was...
Yeah, who wouldn't after living in Spain?
No, some of those paintings of the fish and on the table, the they're so beautiful. But he was influenced by Tapies.
Very much so.
Very much so, yeah. Which people don't really know Tapies so much here.
No,
but is he a Barcelonian?
Yes, Spanish. I don't know if he was Barcelonian, but he lived in Paris.
Yep.
But he uses the same sort of heavy marking on the stone that John does.
Right.
How would people describe, because his work seems to be a mixture of both abstract and figurative work, isn't it? Somewhere in between, because you can recognise things in there, but at the same time you can blur your eyes and it can just be beautiful shapes.
He's been accused of being an abstract artist, but he denies it vehemently that he's an abstract artist. He draws what he sees and what his imagination sees, and he sees it as a real-life painting, whether it's a landscape or an animal. So they do have an abstract quality about them, but they're definitely not abstract works in his mind as he sees it.
I'm trying to think of any Australian abstract artists of any worth. Brett was definitely abstract in the beginning, but still based on the landscape. When you think of those Sitchin paintings in his early 20s, but most painters in Australia seem to be figurative. Yeah.
I think that's true.
They're not fully abstract as people like Rothko
People like Robert Jacks.
We did see some in the field, of course.
That's true. There was that time heavily influenced by the Americans, I think.
Yes. Very much so. We have our share of abstract artists in Australia, but John certainly would hate to be an abstract artist.
Yes, okay. Now, your gallery, which is called John Cecil Fine Art in Arthur's Seat Road in Redhill, what's your specialty there? Generally speaking?
Well, generally, it's, as I say, printmaking is my love and what I have always tried to teach to Australian collectors is the importance of original prints. So I'm a bit one-eyed about that.
Right. Okay, so question finished. And of course, because I visited there on the weekend, or just before the weekend, actually, and there's a beautiful fire going, and you also have a kitchen in there. So it's actually a rather lovely place to, I think, have lunch or have a glass of wine and have a look at some rather spectacular art as well.
Yes, we've tried to create an environment that is sort of fine art, fine food, fine views, because it's a beautiful view.
There are some amazing views there.
And fine wines, of course. So
wouldn't you?
We like to think we're packaging a Mornington Peninsula sort of ideal sort of environment to sit in and enjoy culture and food. So.
Yes, well, it's very exciting to see that.
What are the opening hours again?
We're open Friday, Saturday, Sunday, just those 3 days a week. From 10 in the morning till 5 in the evening.
So. Yeah. I will, of course, make some links on our Facebook page, but we'd love to have you back again. I know that John was kicking himself that he couldn't be here today because he really wants to have a talk to you about those different modes of reproductions and prints and one versus the other. So we might organise something.
I think it's fairly obvious that John's going to
obviously.
Talk about his Giclée prints and
well,
how...
Well, he is.
And his... Yeah, that's the way he makes his prints.
That's right. Well, he's a practicing artist now, and of course it's
and they're very beautiful.
And there's great pressure to do that for all sorts of economic reasons. That's
the way things happen these days, as opposed to people doing the on the stone.
Yeah, the fine difference is that Alexander Stitt, who was a wonderful artist, who used to be a commercial artist and went into doing Giclée prints, but he. Because he was technically proficient on a computer, he drew all his work on his computer with a tablet.
Yes.
And so that would qualify as an original print.
Okay. All right.
Whereas in the other case, they take photographs of a painting and then print it. Yeah. That, to me, in my view, as a bit of a purist, is not.
Not quite the same.
No. So I'm sure.
And do they last as long?
Giclée prints last because they're printed on.
Very good paper.
Very good paper. Very long, long-lasting inks. But as I say,
it's not the same.
Just haven't got that magic.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I think we'll go on about that on another occasion because there's plenty we'll talk about. I expect an animated conversation, perhaps round at yours one afternoon, John. What do you think?
Oh, fabulous. I love it.
Thank you so much for coming on today.
Great pleasure.
The Art of John Olsen is on at John Cecil Fine Art, 164 Arthur's Seat Road in Redhill until the middle of July, I think.
Yes. Correct.
Fabulous. Thanks again.
Thanks, Sally.
Coming up, I have a rather beautiful track from, I always say that, don't I? Yeah. It's called Walk a Mile by Holly Golightly. Committed to introducing arts thinking into politics and promoting creative, scientific and evidence-based ideas to improve the lives of people, the Arts Party emerged in 2013 from a conversation in a Sydney pub between two friends, artist PJ Collins and creative director Barry Watterson, who were both fed up with the state of support of the arts and felt that it was time for a political voice to rise up against the tide of indifference being offered. They began a crowdfunding campaign that has ultimately resulted in an internationally based political movement, with parties currently registered federally in Australia and also in England, Scotland and Wales. The next party registration is expected to occur in Ireland in 2018. And they have a new leader, Barry Kildoulis, and we have him in the program today to talk to us through about what the Arts Party is about, why they need your help and what they stand for. Good morning, Barry. Welcome to Arts About.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for coming on the program today.
My pleasure.
Barry, when someone asks you what does the Arts Party stand for, what's your elevator pitch?
Well, basically that, you know, all the facts and figures show that arts and culture are important to Australians, and yet we have no voice in Parliament and no real political presence. And if the shooters and fishers and the four-wheel drivers can have a voice in Parliament, there seems to be no reason why we shouldn't.
Was it a bit of a curveball when you were elected as leader for the party?
It was a pleasant surprise, I guess you could say. PJ Collins, who you mentioned, I think, in the intro there,
yep,
had been the founder and leader of the party for 5 years and put in an enormous amount of work and effort to start the party and run it. But, you know, it is a volunteer organisation at this point, and it was time for him to have a little bit of a rest, although he's still our party secretary and working hard. He felt it was time to create a different structure, he asked me if I would stand for the leadership, and I couldn't think of a reason why not.
Nobody wants to fall into that Peter Costello hole of saying no too many times and then eventually not ever getting the opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite frightening looking at it. It's very easy to sit back and criticise politicians and, you know, they're I think one of the least popular groups in our society. But when you're on the other side and looking at being a politician, it's quite frightening, really. But it's also a challenge, so it makes it interesting, makes life a bit interesting.
What do you think that the arts can do by electing a political voice?
Well, it would be wonderful to get some people elected to even the state legislatures and certainly the federal. Mainly, as I said before, you know, to have a voice in politics and to be taken seriously. Most politicians, in the lead up to the last federal election, you know, the government, the Liberal Party, had no arts policy whatsoever.
None whatsoever.
The Labor
it was a bit
Party
shocking.
Had to sort of be forced kicking and screaming into announcing one after they were cornered and confronted with the existence of an arts party. And the Greens actually adopted all of our policies and wonderfully gave us credit for them. So it's really about people and you know, we had a slogan that we thought was perhaps a bit silly but sounded good, a rallying cry, which was 1 million votes for the arts. And we actually got over 1.6 million federally. And that's, of course, not first votes, but that's about 10% of the population. We had, you know, no money and very little advertising campaign, just a little bit of social media and word of mouth.
Yes, and some
so
very dedicated.
10% of the population will see the words the Arts Party and vote for it. And that means that they're concerned about arts and culture. And so even if we don't get elected, I think the idea is at this stage to let the major parties take the arts and culture segment seriously. And it's important to our very still sort of quite young society. I mean, we have the oldest culture on earth. In our midst, in our presence, but you know, as a country, Australia is quite young, and we're actually building our culture you know, as we speak. And it's important to a lot of people. Having a voice and having the major parties take arts and culture seriously is pretty much our aim.
Yeah, of course. And to be sort of totally cynical about it, of course, all they really want to do is make sure that, or enable themselves to get into government. And to hear that 1.6 million Australians actually consider the arts to be an important forum to protect is a really important... That's a whole bunch of votes that they could just lay their hands on.
And, you know, we did run candidates in the Senate in all of the states for the Senate, but we also had a number of lower house candidates. And, of course, they got nowhere near winning. But you know, in a number of seats... And we had very few people on the ground, and we did have people handing out, you know, leaflets. The vote was notably higher. But even in some of those seats, you know, the vote was 2 to 3%. And in a close battle, in a lower house seat, that 2 or 3% can make a big difference.
Mark,
sorry,
yeah?
Barry, good morning. When you say, do you mean representation? This is what you're trying to say as the Arts Party, you want to represent the arts in general? Or, I mean, do you have a complete politique that you're presenting to people?
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate goal would be representation in our parliament, because that would be the most effective way of having the arts taken seriously and having our policies implemented.
When you say taken seriously, in what sense do you mean?
You know, we're not just looking for bigger handouts for artists or institutions. Mm. We're looking at arts and culture being thought of as integral to all of our...
To the economy, no? Yeah. This is a very important point, because what I found, I lived in France for many years, and the arts, you know, they have a Minister of Culture, who is basically at the whim of the, you know, the latest fads, and in many ways managed to gender a sense of mediocrity in the arts, because it's so many people fighting for the, you know, for a bit of money here and there, and it doesn't really create that sense of formation that an artist needs by himself in many senses. And so this idea of helping the arts is it's fraught with, you know, a lot of problems, because it can sort of make it lose the formation.
I think I understand what you're saying, and there was an interesting, after the last budget, there was the CEO of NABA, Esther Anatolides. She was on a radio program I just happened to hear when I was driving, and with, I think, a colleague of hers from maybe Arts Hub, and they were sort of looking at the budget from an arts perspective. They, you know, obviously had something to say about what was very little content, because the budget pretty much, apart from taking another $84 million from the ABC, which is, of course, a creator of Australian content for television, radio, etc., there was very little mention of the arts, except to take some of that $84 million and put a memorial to Captain Cook in the Treasurer's electorate.
Yes.
But interestingly, the calls and the tweets after the program were pretty much evenly divided between, you know, the arts are important, you know, and they deserve more support, to 50% of the people saying, you know, just bleeding hearts wanting another handout. It's not about us. It's not about us looking for greater handouts, but it's also about integrating the arts more effectively into other aspects
of our education.
So it's interesting that, you know, about 5 years ago, the federal minister was talking, in terms of education, they were talking about STEAM, which has now become, the focus is on STEM, and the arts have dropped out.
Yes.
So, you know, we would want, you know...
It was called STEAM before, was it? Now it's called STEM. Is that what you're saying?
STEAM, the A was for art.
Yes, so, exactly. And STEM is the science, technology...
STEM, yeah. But the A has somehow...
Gone out. That's outrageous.
So if you were to be there in Parliament, you would be able to
encourage
it. We're still fighting the same problem. That is that we've, you know, I'm an artist, and I don't believe that artists should get too much help, because I think they should, you know, they should be learning themselves what's going on in the world. They don't actually need that help, which is completely, you know, many people will damn
people.
Me
yes.
for that situation. But I've seen in Holland as well, there was extraordinary help from the government towards the artists, and they just got so much rubbish, because they said they'd buy everything an artist made, and they've got these warehouses just full of rubbish, basically. So obviously, you're not talking about that. But then, you know, there's the other aspect. Sorry, the other aspect is that they've realised the Bilbao effect on museums, and how those museums have created so much economic life around them, with the restaurants, cafes, everything going on around the museum. That obviously the Victorian government, with its investment in the arts precinct, has come. You know, they're realising that there is this investment in the end result. It's not in the actually making the artist. But as Plato said, you teach people the harp so they can appreciate it, not so they all become masters of it.
That's right. And also to enhance culture. We absolutely need it in our education system. We absolutely need to recognise its value in our
economic strands.
Depends
on the quality
strands.
Of the arts education.
Well, that's right. But if there is none, that's worse than there being mediocre arts education, I would have thought. So tell me, Barry, what's happening with the Arts Party now? Because we must be about 18 months away from the next election.
Yeah, so we're reassessing our policies and updating our policies. We are looking to begin to contest the state elections. Unfortunately, we won't be able to contest the next New South Wales election, because that has a cut-off point of 12 months before for registration, and that passed earlier this year. But Victoria, I think the cut-off is at the end of this month, beginning of July, and we're just a couple of hundred members short of the required amount in Victoria.
Oh, in order to register here.
A bit of a push to see if we can get registration in Victoria.
Well, there you are. There's a big call out to our Arts About listeners. You can actually participate in and become a member of the Arts Party over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, and we're a very democratic party, so we of course listen to everyone's opinion and take on board what people have to say to us. And membership is free. You can, if one likes, you know, to support the party, you can sort of donate, you know, as little as a cup of coffee a week. Not actually a cup of coffee, but the amount of money to the party to keep it going, because we're much more interested in sort of grassroots support than necessarily, you know, like one big major sponsor to whom you'd become beholden. But the complication, I think, is that it's not there's free membership. You can become a member online, but then I think you do need to go through the process of filling out the Victorian government's form that needs to be returned to them. But we would very much love to run in the Victorian election, just, in terms of getting awareness of the party out there. You know, as I said, for the federal election, when we achieved that something like 10% recognition, it was really on the day, because there was very little pre-publicity that we were able to achieve. So just having the party out there and contesting these elections will increase the awareness for the next federal election as well.
Well, I will, of course, put all sorts of links on our Facebook page, and so people can have a look at what the current policies are and what's going on in the Arts Party now, and maybe even have a look at you, Barry. And thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. We're, of course, very keen on protecting the arts and making sure that they do remain a powerful promoter of culture.
And you know, part of what drives our economy, you know, it's not just
it's very true.
About handouts, you know, Mark was saying about handouts to artists. It's about recognising it
an economic force behind our culture. It's very much so.
Well, it promotes the ability for people to be able to think critically, but of course it does this input into the local economies, and they've done some very interesting studies quite recently, which go forensically into productions that have been invested in by the local government. I'm not sure what the organisation was, but they quite recently they did a study on the MTC's production of something, and discovered that the $3 million investment that they had made had, over the course of several months, with hotels and restaurants and travel and tourism and so on, translated into something that was in the $40 million. It's, you know, so it's not unreasonable to say that this is short-sighted to consider that the arts are a luxury. They're not a luxury at all. They're really important.
No, this is the point which needs to be, people need to know, I think. But I think they are, Barry, actually, when you think of the future is going to be, people are going to have so much more time on their hands. You know, the art and culture will take a hopefully more of a central position in their lives.
One would hope so.
And it's not just, you know, about the magnificent art centres, you know, planned for the major cities like the one that's on the drawing board about in Melbourne, but you know, the regional towns.
Of course.
Yeah, in particular, I think Victoria is particularly well endowed, if I can put it that way, in terms of regional galleries.
Absolutely,
that are quite, they have significant connections, collections, and also attract significant numbers of visitors.
Yes, well, we were recently in Ballarat at the Ballarat Gallery, and it was a wonderful experience. A very lively and you know, it's a thriving place.
Yeah, we do have a very, very powerful network and some incredible collections, as you say, and they're all. Our own local, there are resources. They're state-owned assets, or federally owned assets,
down
I should say.
In the Mornington Peninsula.
Oh, yes. Well, I know we know that you were visiting just this weekend.
And I stopped in at Point Leo.
Yes, the sculpture there. Park
of course,
there.
I think a private concern, but again, the number of people there that were you know part of the reason they were visiting was for the art they could see, and then. Even on the freeway down, it made the drive more interesting to see some large-scale
sculptures. Yes, well, that's the McClellan Gallery in Frankston,
who
are doing that. But it's true that, I mean, obviously, the peninsula is not a poor area.
It's a vibrant.
And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of the big winemakers are making restaurants and sculpture gardens.
Yeah.
It's some better than others.
Well, artsabout.org.au is the website you can go to look at the arts party and find out a little bit more about them. I will, of course, as I say, put links on our Facebook page. But we urge you, and I'm sure you do too, Barry, we urge our listeners to maybe consider becoming a member of a party that might help enhance our lives into the future. Thanks so much for talking to us today, Barry Kildall.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. Lovely talking to you. Good luck.
Thanks. Talk to you.
Bye.
Bye.
I was going to play another song by Mink DeVille, but we're running out of time. So why don't we... You've got a lot to talk about to us today, Mark, haven't you?
Oops, I could do, yes. So, Heaven and Hell.
Heaven and Hell, that's right.
Yes. Now, look, we're going back to Princess Park. That poor girl called Eurydice.
Yes.
In Greek mythology, Eurydice, there are quite a few Eurydices, but the most remembered is the wife of Orpheus, who he tried to bring back from the underground.
Oh, of course, yes.
And I think after what that poor girl went through, if there is a possibility of heaven, that she went there directly.
Yeah, I do hope so.
And whereas the poor, autistic, messed up boy, who is now in a living hell.
Yes.
Now, apparently there was a recent high-up Catholic statement that heaven and hell are actually a state of mind.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
Pope Francis
that, yes.
was talking
to...
It
came from the Vatican, didn't
it? Yes. Well, he was talking to one of his best friends who was a publisher in private, and the publisher...
Oh, was it?
..said that, and so Francis had to explain that, in fact, no, it's a state of mind. It is a state of mind. It's not just this... Whereas to most people, it is this idea of a... Well, we've seen all the paintings, haven't we?
Yeah. Somewhere we go when we cark this mortal coil.
No. But to get back to this Eurydice, who... one thing I really say to many young people is, if you're ever walking alone at night or even during the day, don't have your headphones on so that you can be aware of what's going on around you, so that you can't be taken by surprise because you're in your own world. I know it's lovely to be in there, but it really is. I've seen it so often, people, you're walking at night or even riding a bicycle with headphones on. It's such a dangerous thing to do. I don't know if that was the case. Whatever. I feel so much for the girl, but I also feel for that poor boy who probably didn't even, in some way he's autistic, whether how far autistic he is.
I'm not giving an excuse.
What I'm trying to say is that unfortunately it's like all those boys who shoot up the school kids. It's mostly messed up boys who are sexually frustrated, who can't have any connection to any girls because the girls look at them and go, you're not, there's this competitive edge, as we all know, and those poor boys who don't have that oomph or that, you know, that front, they suffer and they go, and look, I'm not forgiving in any way. Mm. I'm just saying that there is this aspect of boys' education that something has
to be
dealt with,
because
you've got all these hormones just going everywhere, and they don't know where to go.
Well, he hasn't been. He's been failed by a system.
Well, maybe his parents as well. But it's a horrible thing to happen to anybody. So, moving on to Mike Parr. And,
yes, I saw him emerge actually.
The other day. I wasn't really interested in seeing this old man coming out of a roadway.
It's pretty wild.
I mean, he's a bit of a attention seeker, you must say.
Well, of course, he's a performance artist.
And then they say, his performance was described by the creative director of Dark Mofo as. Acknowledge two deeply linked events in Tasmania's history, the eventual transportation of 75,000 British and Irish convicts the first half of the 19th century and the subsequent nearly total destruction of Tasmania's Aboriginal population.
So it was more of a protest, really, than a...
Sorry, how someone digging a hole in the road and putting himself in there for 72 hours has anything to do with that is beyond me. And this is once again another example of the art saying this is what it's about, when in fact it's got nothing to do... I mean, you could say it's about the beginning of the world. You can say whatever you like. It doesn't really have that point at all. So It was a peculiar link,
I have to admit. I did go and see Mike Parr when he did the asylum. Down there, which was much more...
messy.
Yes, it was messy, but it was also a clearer link between the content that he was describing and the art. You could actually sense what it was about. This one is a very strange one because, of course, he's just so completely cut off. I mean, it's a mad thing to do.
Look, he's not the first. There was a guy in London 3 years ago who put himself in a cage up in the air.
Oh, I saw that, yes.
And
yes.
he, there's a lot of people doing this. Chris Burden, the American performance artist who shot himself in the arm, and, you know, it goes on and on. I find the links that they make are just too gratuitous, and people, this is why the general public goes, what the hell are these artists going on about? And they were saying it cost something like $450,000, which could have been given to the poor people.
They had to dig up the road and then stick something in
and
it.
29 and then, buses and then... had to be rerouted, etc. Oh, look, I don't care. I find it a bit bizarre. Anyway, I don't know if you know anything about pie.
Pie, edible pie,
as
or
in
is it
not
pie?
Meat pie, the pie, the
as in the circle,
yes,
the measurement
it's the,
of the circle.
The ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter,
yes,
is 3.14159,
yes,
and it keeps going on to infinity.
Yes.
Okay, there was a 60-year-old Japanese man who recited pi to 100,000 digits in 16 hours, and it was like a spiritual mantra.
Right.
So he managed to remember 100,000 digits of pi, this Japanese man.
Weren't they all nines?
Huh?
Weren't they all nines at the end?
No, I don't think so. I don't know, actually. I haven't gone 100,000 digits past.
Well, once if you six. Go about 3 point, what is it?
It's 3.14159.
Yes, which must then go on. Oh, okay. So it's a...
Yeah, I don't know that. We need to speak to John Baird's brother Andrew, who's a mathematician.
Oh,
maybe
he'd be able to tell us.
We're talking about Dark Mofo as well. Anyway, this was about people who were doing extraordinary things with their minds and their memories. And I'd spoken about Sir Richard Burton, who was a English explorer in the 19th century.
Yes.
Spoke
he wrote,
40,
didn't
40
he
languages.
Translate the Kama Sutra?
Could have.
I think he did.
Not sure.
Yes, he did. Well, maybe it was not the Kama Sutra, but it was a... An Arabian erotic. Oh, I have to look that up.
1001 Nights, then.
No.
Okay, you'll look that up.
Yeah.
There is now an American hyper-polyglot called Alexander Argui, who speaks 70 languages.
70?
Yep. That's not bad. Imagine be a conversationist. And to finish off, there is a famous English professor, Oxford professor, called William McCaskill, who is the leader of an effective altruist movement called Supernaturally Happy. Everything he earns over £25,000, $44,000, he gives away.
What?
He gives away.
Oh.
And points out that 97% of the of the world lives on less. One of his employees, Pablo Stabrini, has 70 possessions, some clothes, a pair of boots, shoes and trousers for tango, because he's Argentinian, two pairs of underpants, which doesn't seem like a lot.
Unnecessary to know that. Yes.
A desk, a decent desktop, and a few bits and bobs. This is from an English journal, which reminds me of Blaise Cendrars, the French poet, or Swiss, I think, actually lived in Paris in the early part of the century, 20th. He had one change of clothes, stayed in hotels and ate in restaurants, and just had a pen and paper. He was a poet. Wow. So it's all about you. Less is more.
Less is more, yes, exactly. And by the way, you were right. It was a Book of the Thousand Nights. Yes.
Okay.
Book of the Thousand Nights and a Night.
All right, yes. So do we have any more time? Or
yeah, you have, actually.
Okay, well, look, this is the thing I was trying to talk about last week, which was
yes.
The
two sisters.
Dorothy Hewitt. Well, they're still going on about it in The Australian today. There's been, and also Andrew Bowles in The Sun talking about what a horrible woman Dorothy was, which you'd expect
of
Andrew.
Yes.
So this is about authors, which Andrew, I'm sure, would love. And how nowadays many authors have a morality clause written into their publishing contracts. If they act immorally, their publishers have the right to drop them. It's not hard to imagine that Ronald Dahl, who was, as I said, was sexually promiscuous, racist, sexist, a liar, etc. This is all described by his wife of 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And who John Cecil, who was a publisher, was saying he met him and he was a lovely man, but of course he wasn't his wife, was he?
No.
So you never know. What they're saying is that if that had been the case, if this morality clause had been put onto him, he wouldn't have been published.
No.
Okay. So they're saying that Charles Dickens was also a cold-hearted egoist.
Yes.
He left his children. He was Virginia Woolf was anti-Semite.
Right.
Even though her husband was Jewish. V.S. Naipaul, who was angry with his wife because she wouldn't die from her breast cancer fast enough.
What?
Well, I mean, that's the sort of thing you hear about and you just wonder. I mean, he says here, according to almost everybody you talk to, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist V.S. Naipaul, but probably, I don't know if that's pronounced, is a nasty piece of work you could hope to meet. He regularly cheated on his first wife, the prostitutes. After she was diagnosed with breast cancer, he was angry with her for not dying fast enough. He wanted to move on and marry his mistress. He is an epic snob, too. I don't know Star Wars. I'm not interested in films, he once told George Lucas at a party. And yet he's the author of I Wish for Mr. Biswas. Would we wish to be without it?
Mm.
I didn't watch Star Wars either.
Oh, so didn't you? Well,
no,
yes.
No.
There are quite a few people that don't like it. I loved it.
The list goes on. Patricia Highsmith, anti-Semite. Philip Roth, sexist. I love her.
Should artists or writers be anything other than just a representation of the rest of the population? I mean, there's horrible people that are dustbin cleaners or gorgeous people.
But that's what it's coming to. They're saying the morality clause in publishing could be the end. It's like anything goes in the art world the more you allow.
You realise that is, of course, it's only about business, and it's businesses wanting to put a morality clause in it, because of course if an author inflames their audience against them, they're not going to sell as many books, and that's what it's about. Were it to be a government decree, it would have a different meaning, but
yeah.
I think it's really
what they used to do before was say, oh, we're not really, we're not sure about this, and publish it and get all the bad publicity, and that would sell more books.
Yes, well,
so they're going to miss out.
Actually,
they could miss out on both sides. But
it's that political correctness just going. It's getting its fingers into everything.
Yep.
I agree.
Yeah, no, look, it's going there, but then apparently it's changing. It's going the other direction. We're just not aware of it yet.
Oh, the pendulum has begun swinging opposite.
I think so. Well, look, as you know, each generation changes so quickly. The opposite to what the one before was.
Yes.
And so it's a, we never really know what's going on. This is, I think, the basis of our world problem. We seem to be so sure of ourselves, but nobody really knows what's going on.
No one has a clue.
But we do know that this is about to end.
Yes, it does, because, hark, it's time for the news. Dark Mofo is upon us, of course. Oh, here, I haven't given Mark his news list. Yes, Dark Mofo's on us. We are hoping that we're going to speak with Drew Baird at some point about being on the ground, because I'm not there this year, which I'm rather disappointed about.
No.
Anyway, the arts party needs you. Our culture is being eroded by indifference. Why don't you consider becoming a member and helping them get a place at the political table?
Mick Yankovic. Sorry. Luminist is on at Merrick's Art Gallery.
Yes. Home of the Boyds is on at Bunjil Place in Casey until the end of July.
The Art of Jordan Olsen, a collection of limited edition prints, opens at the John Cecil Fine Art Gallery on Redhill Road on June the 9th until the end of July.
That's right. Now, John Anderson has an exhibition opening this week at Australian Galleries, and I think it's going to be hanging until the end of July. We're going to go and see it, so I expect we might be talking about it, and hopefully maybe even with him next week. We're also going along to the Buxton Gallery.
That's true.
Yes.
So the new acquisitive, let's hope the Buxton show is better than the last one. The new
acquisitive
prize splash that McClelland has created is open to all you watercolourists. Entries accepted until September the 12th.
Yes, so you've still got plenty of time. If you've just tuned in, you've missed Arts About. But you can hear the repeat on Wednesdays at 12 or listen to the podcasts on the station website. You can also listen to us on air and streaming, or there's even a radio app you can listen to us now on, or also there's some fabulous new website that I've got the podcasts on, which will make listening to it a little bit easier and a bit easier to find what you might be interested in listening to. You know, if you've missed the program, you can catch up that way. So have a look on our Facebook page. You'll hear all about some of our guests and some of the things that we've been talking about. We're going to be on again same time next week, 11 a.m. Sunday. And remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art.
I have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about.
Oh, I think sometimes you do, Mark.
I make a good... I'm
yeah, you get loud.